Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Fears of the novel coronavirus are rippling through the economy, adding to the potential public health crisis. Macroeconomic policies can't address a pandemic per se, but perhaps they can address the economic troubles left in the wake of once this particular threat subsides. Joe Santos is professor of economics and Dykehouse scholar of money, banking, and regulation in the Ness School of Management and Economics at SDSU. He's joining us for this week's Morning Macro segment, and you can follow along with our conversation on his website at schooled.blog.com. Joe Santos joins us now from the Janine Basinger Studio at South Dakota State University. Welcome back, Joe.
Thank you, Lori.
All right. It feels like we're standing in unknown territory in a lot of ways. So tell me a little bit about how we begin thinking about macroeconomic policies being suited to this particular crisis.
Yeah, that's a big question, but one I thought we better address, right?
Yeah, right.
Let's say it is a global pandemic. There is really nothing in the macroeconomic policy tool shed, if you will, that specifically addresses the immediate consequences of this sort of crisis. Monetary policy can't create a vaccine. But as you mentioned in your intro, the consequences of this sort of global slowdown, if that in fact is what the crisis unleashes, are the sorts of things driven by expectations on the parts of households, concerns, uncertainties on the parts of business and so forth. Those are the sorts of things that policies might be able to address. But again, the immediate effect, unfortunately, there is a feeling of macroeconomic hopelessness or helplessness. The Federal Reserve, in concert with other central banks, now are discussing, as we speak, the possibility of lowering interest rates somewhat substantially, at least relative to what the plan was even 3 weeks ago, which was essentially to probably do nothing. Mm-hmm. So there are discussions of immediate policy. And in fact, if anyone's watching the markets right now, which is kind of hard not to do, you'll notice things are very green as opposed to red this morning, because the anticipation is that the Fed may, in fact, react. And some of that is arithmetic. If interest rates go down, then the current valuation of a firm that is presumably going to generate profits far off into the future goes up. So all else equal, lower interest rates mean higher stock prices. But again, whether or not lower interest rates really can do anything immediately is a very open question.
So how do we start visiting this macroeconomic tool shed to take a look inside and sort of see what we can see?
Yeah. So, you know, if the crisis is going to do anything, and I suspect it will, it's not going to be the end of days, but it will have macroeconomic consequences. It's already having those consequences, say, in China. And China is a very large part of the global economy now. So those consequences are going to ripple through the world economy. There's no doubt about any of that. The question is really just scale. The uniqueness of this, economically speaking, pandemically speaking, it's got its own uniqueness. But economically speaking, is that it drives both demand and supply, right? So I'll leave it to an economist to bring up supply and demand within the first 4 minutes of a conversation. But, on the demand side, you can imagine individuals who are perhaps temporarily unemployed, separated from the labor force, or perhaps just not inclined to go to the marketplace, literally wanting to stay somewhat isolated, not being sure of what the future holds for their household income. And so those are sort of demand features that can slow demand, slow spending. And that's actually something that macroeconomic policy generally could address. Unfortunately, the supply chain consequences of this crisis, literally not being able to get the goods to where you need them and so forth, and more importantly, to produce the goods that you need to produce, because again, those goods require a combination of machinery and labor, and labor contracts viruses. So you end up with this gumming of the production works that also has supply consequences. So it really is two forces acting against the macroeconomy, both obviously in the wrong direction, the second of which, there aren't a lot of policy prescriptions in general, even if this were not a virus-induced supply shock. Supply shocks are an order of magnitude more difficult to address with policy. But anyway, getting back to your question, though, what is in the tool shed? Well, we've already discussed monetary policy. So that would be essentially moving interest rates. And in this case, it would mean lowering interest rates to try to stimulate demand. Again, there's that focus on demand. It's about all you can do with monetary policy is stimulate demand. You also, though, have fiscal policy, which listeners will be forgiven for forgetting about because we never talk about. But fiscal policy is, of course, changing tax rates and changing spending, presumably temporarily, in response to some sort of macroeconomic crisis. So this is stabilization policy. It's not to be used all the time. But when it is used temporarily in these very specific ways, that too can be a way to deal with an economic slowdown. So you can lower interest rates on the monetary policy side of the ledger, if you will. But you can also lower taxes. You can increase government spending. Again, not to put too fine a point on this or be too grim, but none of this, of course, is in any way a vaccine. But right. These are ways of dealing with the aftermath.
So one of the things before we kind of get into breaking down like allocation policy and stabilization policy, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you is the importance, because we've talked about before, of certainty when we're talking about international trade and trade deals, the certainty mm-hmm. People want to feel like, you know, you mentioned today the markets are, you know, recovering a little bit in the anticipation that some action is going to be taken. And I'm wondering about some of these companies who are taking action. Amazon comes to mind. Early, you know, restricting travel and making, you know, new hires or you know, video conference only. They're already taking some sort of restricting of movement action. Is that just protecting their business or does that have an impact on their stocks that they're demonstrating to, you know, to the public that we know what we're doing. We've got a plan sure. and we're taking action already.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think there definitely is a conventional wisdom, and conventional wisdom isn't always correct, of course, but a conventional wisdom out there that doing something is better than doing nothing. And so perhaps there can be a sort of second order objective. I wouldn't say it's a first order, but a second order objective to try to appear to be doing something that's effective and sensible in a way that can prop up the valuation of the firm. But I do think the first order objective is to try to do business, if you will, through the crisis. And that will, you know, necessarily mean reorganizing production processes, if not manufacturing supply chains. There's not a lot you can do there in the short run. But certainly the way you organize individuals, the way they meet, and you mentioned things like, you know, using technology to meet and so forth. I think that's probably a first order goal there is to try to keep business running. You mentioned certainty and its other side, uncertainty. And that's really, I think, what is gripping not just financial markets, which are in some respects, larger respects, I think, than most will admit, a reflection of economic activity more generally. These markets are dealing with uncertainty, and uncertainty is different than risk. This is a little in the weeds, but economists don't use the terms interchangeably. Sure. When you're referring to risk, you're referring to really understanding what we call the probability distribution. I could tell you there's a 20% chance something's going to happen. There's a risk it could happen. I'm using the word risk because I have a sense of how the probabilities lay out. Uncertainty is terrifying for commerce because that's where, again, very, very, you know, technically speaking, you don't know what the distribution looks like. You have no idea what the curve looks like, the bell curve or whatever. You can't identify it. So you don't have any sense of how bad is. You don't know where the bottom is. And I think that's right now what we're seeing is firms are dealing really with uncertainty as opposed to risk. And that more than anything will drive market valuations down. And so as a practical matter, stock prices down. Again, there's always a bit of overreaction in a world of quarterly capitalism, as we call it, where these firms have to demonstrate their worth, you know, every 3 months. And so they focus on the short term and traders focus on the short term, perhaps more than they should. But there is a good reason for the downward pressure in the value of these firms.
All right, let's talk about allocation policy, redistribution policy, and stabilization policy.
Okay, so yeah, those are the three bits to essentially fiscal policy, though macroeconomists would really just think of stabilization policy as fiscal policy. So again, fiscal policy is using taxes and spending, but if you're using taxes and spending to try to change the existing wedges of the pie. That's redistribution. So that's not about producing more stuff. Allocation policy is trying to use tax policy in a way to really increase the efficiency of the economy. So there's nothing particularly wrong with the economy when you're implementing allocation policy. You just think that perhaps government could adjust its position in the economy in such a way that goods are allocated more efficiently. And then there's stabilization.
Give me an example of that.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Lower taxes, marginal income tax rates on labor, okay. Or lower taxes on in certain types of investment spending. So if you think that a particular use of labor or a particular use of machinery and equipment or an innovation of that sort of machinery and equipment would motivate more economic output than we have now, you think you can do this by tweaking tax rates, that would be allocated.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So stabilization is the one we think of when we're talking about a recession. So strictly speaking, if the government were to talk about lowering taxes right now or increasing government spending in order to deal with an economy that's underwhelming because it's producing less than we reason it could at its potential, there's that gap there, and you're trying to close that gap, that's when we really think of fiscal policy as a stabilization policy. And so, as I sort of joke in the blog, it's right now we often think of it as the dullest tool in the shed. I'm not necessarily advocating that we go out and use it, but it is another policy tool. And historically, for the last several decades, with the exception of the financial crisis in 2008, we have not thought of fiscal policy as a go-to policy. It has been monetary policy that has played that role. And again, I think you're seeing this in very real time this morning. The White House, spoke open letter form to the Fed saying you need to get in there and make things right or fix things or at least ameliorate the damage that this is causing. That's not just this administration. That's been the sort of go-to mentality for several decades. And so fiscal policy, taxing and spending to stabilize the economy has not been the first thing we reach for on the, you know, the policy shelf, if you will, for several decades. The heyday of fiscal policy was probably in the late 60s, early 70s. And since then, it's been sort of taken a back seat to monetary policy as our go-to.
Is that because of whose responsibility it is?
Well, this is where our friends in political science, I think, have a lot more to contribute here than than my friends in economics.
Yeah.
Because the political scientists have long taken this view that, and other fields, sociologists have played an important role in all this as well, is that basically it's a blame game. And the Fed, because of its perceived autonomy, it's, you know, independent, we like to say, whether or not that's accurate. There's a great book called The Myth of Independence. You can imagine where that one's going.
Yeah.
But this independence affords not just the administration, but also the legislature, the opportunity to essentially assign blame to the Fed when things are not going well. So when they are going well, things are just going well. So you can just benefit from the sort of afterglow of that. But also you can say, well, it's going well because the legislature essentially identified this central bank and positioned it in an independent way so it could do all the right things. So ultimately it comes back to its creator, the Congress, for taking credit. And when it doesn't do well, then you could very easily point the finger at the central bank and say, well, this is your domain. Macroeconomics is monetary policy. They're one and the same. There's nothing we could do. In fact, the statement from the administration this morning, and this is, again, not specific to this administration. You can find other statements like this in other days, was the Fed needs to do something. I don't think the Congress could act with tax cuts anytime soon. You know, that was I'm paraphrasing. But that's textbook. That's what we've seen for several decades. And so there are folks out there right now who are advocating for a more active role for fiscal policy. I'm not necessarily doing so here, but I'm just saying that's a growing force in macroeconomics right now, sort of arguing that perhaps fiscal policy should be allowed to come back into the policy space in ways that it hasn't been for decades.
What do we know as we look at school.blog.com? How did you sort of work some numbers up to show us the impact of this kind of policy in the past? Let's go look at a little history.
Sure. So I took some great work by Christina and David Romer, who's a macroeconomics dynamic duo at UC Berkeley, who've done a lot of work, not just on the effects of fiscal policy, but in the process of trying to identify what they determine are actually quite significant effects of changes in taxes. So stabilization policy through tax changes could work is sort of the punchline of their work. But in the process of doing that work, they had to go back and look at the narrative record for evidence that the Congress and the administration even intended, right, to implement fiscal policy. You have to find that shock in order to test if it had any effect on the economy. So there's this really interesting byproduct of their work where they go back into the all sorts of congressional records and economic reports of the president and some, I'm guessing, poor RAs who spent sleepless nights going deep into this narrative record and saying, okay, this one is stabilization policy. Put this in that pile. That one, you know, that piece of legislation is allocation policy, to use the term you used earlier. Put it in that pile. And so you end up with these piles that you could take a look at. And so this is what I put up on school, are these charts where they're just spikes and they're events, they're stabilization events driven by fiscal policy. And what you notice is there are a bunch of spikes until about the 80s, and then the spikes mostly disappear. It's a pretty interesting image. There's a lot of fiscal policy before about the 80s and essentially no evidence of it from their work after. And in fact, their term is, you know, the heyday term I used earlier was their term describing roughly the 60s to the 70s. So it wasn't necessarily the objective of their work, but in doing their work, they you know, went through the congressional record and determined that fiscal policy, particularly through tax cuts or increases, if you're trying to slow an economy down, have become quite rare in the last several years.
And again, is there an indication that that is a political winds sort of transformation, or were there reasons to look back from a macroeconomic standpoint and say it wasn't working, or there were consequences that were not, you know, that made it less effective, or is it just politically divisive? What do we have an indication thereof? Yeah.
I that's a good question. I think part of it probably had to do with economic crises in the 70s that were attended by inflation, which is sort of the purview of the Fed. So that's sort of put the focus on the Fed. And then you had a kind of a new norm in American culture that was, you know, smaller government perhaps could be better and so on. And, you know, a Reagan revolution and so on in the 80s and early 90s that sort of continued with the first Bush administration. And so, yeah, I think there was the sort of intellectual norm that said, look, fiscal policy really isn't the solution. And I cite Robert Lucas in his 2003 presidential address where he said in a mostly nonpartisan way that, you know, our emphasis on the business cycle is sort of needs to diminish because that problem's been solved. You know, all ironies aside, 5 years later, there's a financial crisis. But nevertheless, that was the thinking. And I think some of it, to your point, was driven by politics and a concern for the financial consequences. The debt is quite large now. Mm-hmm. The deficit is quite large, both as a share of GDP. And so I think some folks are just looking at that and thinking, look, there's really no ammunition here. We can't move. We don't have the policy space on the fiscal side.
Interestingly, though, a move would not have to be permanent. A move, you know, when we look at what the Fed does, we're constantly watching them to see what the next move will be. If you lowered taxes at a particular time, with the idea that you would raise them again when things had stabilized, you know, who wants to be the person to raise the taxes after you?
This is such a good point, and that's the other side argues. Look, there are deficits, there are debts, but you don't. Part of that is because the fiscal policy has actually been pro-cyclical. We've cut taxes during expansions, let's say. Yeah. If we were more disciplined about this and reserve stabilization policy only for stabilization and not to sort of goose the economy, which, again, is across party lines, then to your point, it wouldn't have to be this case where you lower taxes and then it becomes persistent and you never raise them again. There could be a new intellectual norm, a sort of macroeconomic culture where we all understand, as you said, that just like the Fed lowers rates and then raises them, you could lower taxes during a crisis and then you could restore tax policy to what it was before the crisis, and in doing so, restore the fiscal position of the government. So it needn't have this long-term effect on the budgetary position of the United States Treasury in the way that it often does, precisely because, as you said, every step in the process involves discretion, and nobody wants to be the one that turns the dial back up on the tax rate.
So can it be automated in some ways, that there is a sense of we all understand what the parameters are, and we are at least encouraged, we being, you know, Congress, encouraged mm-hmm. to act accordingly once those markers show up? Can it, you know, can you take the human politics out of it at all?
You can try. That's very popular on monetary policy side. It's not as popular on fiscal, but the theory applies here as well. That is, if you had a rule, you'd have a commitment mechanism. And I would add a second order effect, which is you and I may not fret to the extent that we fret and act preemptively when we see the economy slowing if we understand that there is a response that's going to be imposed by a rule, right? We can, as you said, sort of adopt the rule in our everyday life, recognizing that there will be some sort of automatic stabilizer beyond the sorts of automatic stabilizers that exist now. And from that, we may be able to restore our own confidence. So there's a lot of theory behind why something like that would work. But of course, fiscal policy necessarily involves congressional appropriations in some form, and, you know, tax policy and so forth. And that is inherently political, as, you know, perhaps it should be. But nevertheless, we haven't managed to depoliticize it, relatively speaking, to the extent that we have monetary policy. And so it's very difficult to establish that sort of commitment. But there are folks who are actively working in this field, arguing that what you just suggested, a sort of policy rule implemented for fiscal policy, might be what we need. And the rule would also indicate that rates would have to go up, you know, when certain indicators suggested that they should go up. And so you would have to do that in both directions. And so back to your earlier point, perhaps fiscal policy wouldn't mean raiding the Treasury, you know, every time you lower taxes and then fail to raise them again.
It seems like we have, just from the conversations I've had in the past week, more confidence in our healthcare system to create a vaccine, for example, in our medical research, and the quickness with which that can be done, almost an aggressive confidence in that versus an aggressive confidence, judging from the stock market, in how the fiscal policy is going to play out here. So our human behavior is indicating to me that we have more trust in one thing than the other, and maybe not rightfully so.
May
it's a
I respond?
Big, broad statement.
with
no facts behind it, just what I've been hearing this weekend.
Sure. I mean, there's no policy tool that is sensitive, can any way affect, you know, the virus. I mean, epidemiologically speaking, of course. But I think there are things that policy can do in the aftermath, and to the extent that there's concern or doubt, I wonder if perhaps, and I don't have any data on this one either, so touche here, if it's so much that we don't think that it could work as we don't know that it will be implemented. I think that may be some of the concern, is uncertainty around implementation.
Yeah. Right. There you go. All right. Fascinating stuff. Joe Santos, professor of economics and Dyke House scholar of money, banking, and regulation in the Ness School of Management and Economics at SDSU. And you can find his blog online, schooled.blog.com. Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, Lori.